Hi there. Welcome back to Brown Game Strong. I'm your host, Mithali, and that is a crow outside my window. If you are a new listener, then welcome. If you are a returning listener, then thank you so much for sticking with me. So I know every week or every time I put out an episode, I always say how excited I am. And it's because all of the episodes are actually really exciting. And so I have yet another very exciting episode for you today. It's with Jonah Batumzi, and he is the creator and founder of Blindian Project. Now, I found Blindian Project on my Instagram just, I think, randomly in summer. And honestly, what struck me and I think has still stuck with me is the fact that it made me realize that growing up, Black and Indian couples were never celebrated. It was always something that was spoken about in hushed tones. It was a source of shame, and you would never openly, or I never openly saw, you know, Black and South Asian couples or Indian couples specifically, you know, just being a normal part of like the Indian community where I grew up. And maybe that's just because, you know, it just happened to not happen, but also, I do know that there is sort of one of those attitudes among like elders within our community. It's probably a fear of the unknown, of like not understanding a different culture. And what this episode made me realize is how many more similarities we have among the two cultures, and really among any two cultures, if you think about it, than we have differences. That's why I think this episode is just absolutely excellent, and I'm just so thrilled to have Jonah on this podcast. Now, Jonah himself is a Ugandan-American multidisciplinary creative with a focus on community building. His work focuses on uplifting the underdog and connecting communities through online and offline activations. In 2017, Batumzi created the Blindian Project to share the stories of Black and South Asian couples. And he's doing it so well, by the way. The globally crowdsourced art-based documentary project aims to normalize Black and South Asian relationships and dismantle anti-Blackness within both communities. Now, just a disclaimer, I do mention BLM in this episode, and I just want to highlight that I'm aware that Black Lives Matter has been an ongoing movement for a very long time, but the context that I refer to it in is the recent surge in the conversations around Black Lives Matter throughout 2020 this year. Another thing I also want to mention is that we speak about Indian and South Asian kind of interchangeably at times, but again, very conscious that, you know, South Asian culture is very, very broad. And I think with this particular episode, we have a bit more of a focus on the Indian experience. That aside, I also have a very small request for you. If you enjoy the episode to come, and if you've enjoyed the previous ones, then please, please take some time to leave us a rating on either Apple Podcast or Spotify, wherever you listen to this podcast. So it makes the world of a difference, and it just allows more people to be able to discover these stories and listen to them. So I appreciate you, and I also just want to remind you that you are loved and you are beautiful, and I hope that you have the most wonderful week ahead. Sending you all my love, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, Jonah. Thank you so much for being with us today on Brown Game Strong podcast. I'm so excited to chat with you. How are you doing?
I'm not doing bad. Thanks for asking. And thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and all your lovely community as well too. So thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thank you for all the work that you're doing. I do want to tell everyone how I came across the work that you're doing and how I came across you. Sure. So I don't exactly actually remember, but I do know that the Blindian Project Instagram page popped up for me sometime a few months ago. I want to say somewhere deep in the middle of lockdown. And I think it was obviously during the time of the BLM movement, and everyone was talking about that. And I think it was very interesting, actually, when we spoke on the phone a few weeks ago and you asked me, you know, if BLM hadn't happened, would you have reached out? And that really got me thinking. Do you think that you've had a lot more traction with it after the movement?
Definitely. And like I say, and I said it to yourself, and I say it to other people that I speak to as well, too, is, you know, I went a long time with trying to pitch the project and speak to other people about collaborating and just working together, really. And I guess kind of the overarching feeling that I had is that a lot of these South Asian organizations or individuals I was speaking to or trying to reach, just really almost that feeling of not wanting to be the bad auntie or an uncle who kind of introduces somebody to something, something taboo. It's kind of like that, oh, I don't want to be the first person to give you a sip of alcohol, or just being an enabler, really. And I felt that after the George Floyd incident, BLM movement, however you want to frame that, once that happened, it felt like there was really a reckoning within the South Asian community to look at themselves and figure out how they may perpetuate anti-blackness, or how they may contribute to it, and how are they really being good allies. So once that started and people started questioning things and just speaking a bit more, it was people's focus kind of turned to how can we support our Black brothers and sisters? How can we provide our platforms to help people and amplify the message? So I definitely feel that it has opened the door to some of these conversations that have just really been swept under the rug for a very long time.
Definitely. I can talk for myself. I started to think a lot more about how I was behaving, how I was perpetuating anti-blackness in my own little ways without even realizing. And a lot of it was just unpicking those things within ourselves. You know, that inherent sometimes racism that we grow up with, we are surrounded by it. Often growing up in the South Asian community, I think it is definitely something that's so casually thrown around. And it's only as you get older, I think, you realize as well that, okay, hold on a minute, that's not okay. I need to start questioning these things.
Sure.
And one thing that I would say I learned during these conversations after what happened with George Floyd was that a lot of the stuff we knew, like we knew that things weren't right, but it's only because it was such an uncomfortable topic that it was not something you knew how to really bring out or bring up in conversation.
Sure.
So I found that it was actually very liberating being able to speak about these things. But I'll be honest with you, maybe that's the reason why that your page popped up for me. I don't know. But what I know is interracial relationships and marriages, and especially, you know, this whole idea of, oh, you can't marry a Black person or a Muslim person or a white person, or this whole idea of the BMW, which is such a, you know, such a sick joke in the community. It is definitely something I've grown up hearing, and it's always something I've questioned, you know, and I definitely know that for a lot of us in the South Asian community, it is a big question mark. And so I want to know from you, what motivated you to start Blindian Project? And can you tell me a little bit about your own personal experience that led you to it?
Yeah, sure. So I think thinking about it, so my family comes from Uganda, first of all, which many people will know, or for people who don't know, there was a large kind of South Asian community in Uganda for quite some time, rubbing shoulders with the indigenous Ugandan people in, I think, early 70s, I think it was. Idi Amin threw South Asians out. And for me, really, that's kind of where the story starts. My parents obviously formed their own opinions and had their own experiences with South Asian people. So that was kind of the start of it. And then I was, they fled Uganda along with a lot of other people. And I was born in Chicago. Grew up in the Midwest. We moved a bit away from Chicago. And I never really had, I can probably count on one hand the amount of South Asian people I had interactions with. Had a few people that I studied with in school. This would have been when I was younger. Never really mixed much, or never really hung out much with them, or really had any knowledge of the culture at all, really, to any great extent. And I remember I went to study abroad before I graduated from university, studied in Dublin. And my wife, Sveta, just happened to be visiting a friend who lived in my dormitory. So she was just over for about a week and a half, visiting a friend, and I happened to meet her at my local pub, romantically named the Mad Hatter. So so that's how we started, and it was little by little that I, you know, started learning more about the culture and just being introduced to, you know, wonderful things like the foods and festivals and things like that. And as I, you know, was encountering and immersing myself in this experience, it just really shone on me how many similarities there are between, you know, between our cultures, whether it's, you know, family, food, and just kind of outlook on life and importance on, you know, what's important and what our parents, more importantly, kind of value as being important. Fast forward a couple of years, me and my wife were married. Fortunately, we didn't encounter any of the challenges that a lot of Blindian couples experience, like threat of, you know, being disowned and things like that. And I'll always remember at our wedding, aunties, mostly aunties, would always tell me, you know, I know of another couple where a person married a black person, essentially a Blindian couple. And I never really sought these couples out or really asked very much more. I just know that I never encountered or met any of them. And it was 2017. I was traveling to India. This first trip I was taking with my family and two kids. And I remember the day before I was leaving, there was something that popped on my phone. It was an Al Jazeera article about Africans getting beaten up by street mobs, effectively, in India. And I never really had thought about the whole anti-blackness up until this point in time. It really was, I just knew that there was a reason that our relationships were scarce, as you could call them, or they just weren't really normalized. But at that point in time, I started thinking about anti-blackness and just doing a bit more research and talking to people a bit more. Went over there, had a great trip. Everything was fine. I've had a good time every time I've traveled over there. When I came back, I put out a call to action to any other Blindian couples. And I remember I had 10 stories from around the world, various people who contributed. Some were long, some were short. Some of them were just a sentence here and there, or just a snippet of their experience. And I put it out into the world. And that was it, kind of spreading its wings and flying for the first time. So that's how the project started, really.
That's fascinating. And what I find most interesting about it is how organic it was.
It was great. It was one of those, because I'm a creative, like I had been dabbling with all different sorts of projects, you know, just really, to be honest, expressing myself and being curious about the world and being curious about people. And, you know, it usually revolved around, you know, certain different themes. You know, black fatherhood was one of them. Just this idea of blackness in general, black culture, traveling. I told you I met my wife in Dublin when I was studying abroad. Travel was a very big part of my life and still is. And just another way to experience and introduce ourselves and others to culture. So all of these have really been kind of lived and life experiences and things just that make me happy and intrigue me, really. So you're right. It was natural. It was organic. It was not even really thinking of what it could actually become at that point in time. Like I said, it was more about like you're almost like releasing a dove into the world. And you know, that part where you kind of let it fly out of your hands and then it just goes and kind of takes on a form of its own, really.
Yeah, I think sometimes the most amazing things come out in that way, because if you overthink it, overplan it, you're already limiting yourself. So it's actually really nice that you sort of just let it kind of take its own form.
Definitely.
And I have so many questions about this, and I will get to it, but I actually want to take a few steps back. And I want to ask you a little bit about what it was like growing up. You mentioned you grew up in Chicago.
Yes.
What was that experience like? Were you very close to your culture?
I call it Chicago because 99% of the people won't know the place if I tell them otherwise. So the place I actually spent most of my kind of adolescence or childhood was a place called Bloomington Normal. It is it's directly between Chicago to the north and St. Louis to the south, which are two kind of drastically different cities as well, too. So I grew up in a community that was about, I'd say, 150,000 big. It was conservative. I'd say it's probably about 80 to 85% white. It feels very artificial. It's got some big corporations there as well, too. It's got some universities there. So there are not a lot of other places I can say that are like it. It was a great place to grow up. You know, I was safe. I played basketball. I'll call myself, or I'll say that I was kind of a basketball star when I was growing up. So I was privileged in that sense as well, too. No, it was good. It was good. I had a cousin who lived probably about 30, 45 minutes away from where I lived. And there was a family of about seven or eight. They were Ugandan as well, too. And I remember on the weekends, sometimes our parents would go over there and take our family over there, mix with their family, and, you know, just break bread over food and talk and laugh and just enjoy life as, I was going to say, kind of foreigners in a different world. I mean, we're all first gen over there and stuff. I think we were all trying to deal with a lot of things that I think a lot of people from the South Asian community can relate to, really. It's just this kind of immigrant experience. Yes, we were, you know, Black and probably looked African-American to 99.5% of the people. But at the same point in time, we were living a somewhat different life behind closed doors with parents who were, trying to adapt to a new culture and raise kids in a new culture and also trying to allow us the space and the freedom to kind of form our own identities as well, too.
Yeah, I think so many of us can relate to that. Definitely recording episodes with different people. I've spoken to people who've had very drastically different experiences with the diaspora, or like growing up first gen. You know, some people were really, really ashamed of it. Other people are kind of like, yeah, no, I totally embraced it. Like, I never thought about it. And it's so interesting actually just hearing that diversity. Where do you think you stand or stood on the spectrum? Were you very, very kind of proud of your roots? Were you kind of just like, oh?
It took a lot of growing into, to be honest. It was constantly evolving. I remember being at, anywhere from the age of kind of 8 to 12 to 15. I mean, in the States, when I was growing up, you know, you did roll call at the beginning of school or class. And so they'd go through the names, you know, A to Z. And my last name's Batumzi. So I was towards the front. And I just remember teachers always struggled, you know, saying my name. They always kind of choked up on it. And, you know, when you're young and stuff and kids would hear the teachers butcher my name. And it was very much like, you know, that point in time when people start kind of laughing and giggling. And I think that kind of brings its own, you know, you're with young kids, you're growing up, you're trying to form your identity. And there's this part of you that you don't know how to feel about it, really. You know that people are laughing at you. And, you know, every morning that when day starts, you know, it's going to be your name that the teacher can't pronounce. So, you know, this kind of otherness and feeling different. As I grew older and looking back on it now, it's still kind of evolving and growing. Started traveling back to Uganda actually when I was probably about 11 or 12. We'd go in the summertime for about a month. And I remember first couple trips just kind of not being embarrassed, but just it felt like a chore almost to be going over there for a month. But looking back at it now, like being able to spend those valuable years with my grandparents and my family and extended, you know, time there at, we'd go there for like a month. Like it was just beautiful, and it taught me so many different things in life and being able to, you know, value what we have and value experiences and family, and just really made a mark and on my life and had a big impact on who I am today.
Do you think you would have been quite different had you not had that experience?
Oh, 100%. Like I remember, like, because I told you about my connection to basketball and things like that, and I just remember one occasion, like I really wanted these Michael Jordan shoes. Like I thought they were going to make me play better and win the championships and all of this stuff. And I remember like crying to my mother because I really wanted these shoes. And she was like, no, I'm not going to spend $115 on these shoes. And we went over to Uganda, and I remember walking outside of the house of where my grandparents lived. And they were like kids and a lot of kids, you know, walking by, you know, barefoot, without any shoes. And, you know, it just kind of hit me that I was crying because I couldn't get a pair of $125 shoes. And there were kids walking around with no shoes at all. So, it just kind of put things in perspective at a very young age for me.
Absolutely. It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
I get such a reality check whenever I go back to India. I remember there was one time, so my grandma goes to this, we call it an ashram. So it's basically a homeless shelter.
Okay.
And I think I was also in a period of my life where I was just complaining about everything, or I was just really unhappy maybe. And you go and you walk into this ashram and you see all kinds of people, all kinds of misery, you know, people who are suffering. And I know it's very cliche, but when you really see that in front of your eyes, you just think, oh my gosh, like we are in a completely different bubble where of course, our problems are valid, right? Like, we should never invalidate our issues or like the things that make us feel low. But it does ultimately put it into perspective. And I think going back and like being close to those roots does really give that to you.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Like I said, life lessons really that, you know, you start to feel privileged and you recognize your privilege, and it just put things in perspective. And I think the younger that you can get that type of appreciation, for those type of things, the better. You know, it drives you to achieve and do better and try to create great things. I mean, I think about where my father came from and mother even, and the conditions that they, you know, overcame to give us these great opportunities. And you are thankful for, you know, these tremendous journeys that our families took to bring us over to a new land and embed themselves in the culture and just do it, really.
Absolutely. And you get older and you just learn to appreciate it all. You know, all those things that sometimes brought you shame or made you confused, made you question why you weren't more like, you know, the majority that was around you, which, you know, in where you grew up and where I grew up, it was probably majority white. So yeah, that's so interesting that there's so many parallels and similarities. Moving on to college and kind of getting a bit older, do you think that your experience changed and your mindset changed when you were sort of, you know, going into that new environment?
University was really interesting. So I went to university on a basketball scholarship. So I attended Northwestern University for a year on scholarship. I was there, which is Evanston, north side of Chicago. Great school, great campus. I was playing basketball. Playing basketball in university as a scholarship athlete is a different experience altogether. You're not the typical student who gets to, you know, go out to, I guess, as you guys call it over here, like freshers weekend and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Anything like that. Your education is being paid for. That's your job almost, you know. So before school, you could be going to practice, going to class, getting done with class, going to practice again, then going to study hall, and then going to sleep, and then doing it all over again. So that experience is different from a lot of other student experiences. I remember when my eligibility ran out, because it took me a bit longer to finish university than the standard 4 years, I took this opportunity to study abroad. And not only did I meet my wife, but it just opened my eyes to the world, really. I know, being trapped in that kind of basketball bubble that I was, and then stepping out to, you know, study abroad. It was right after September the 11th. Ireland had not joined the EU yet. I don't think they joined it until kind of December of that year. I was a, you know, black person, black face, black body there in a place that really was not that diverse at that point in time. So everyone knew that I wasn't, you know, Irish or anything. They knew I was from the States. And, you know, people were asking me what my thoughts were on U.S. foreign policy. They're asking me what I thought about some wars that the U.S. participated in. And I really had never thought about the U.S. in that way before. And I think that's probably kind of similar to a lot of people who never traveled abroad. If you live in a place where you are, I guess, kind of led to believe you're number one, and you're not getting this information, history about the world, really from school sources. You might be told about World War I and World War II and slavery and things like that, but you're not really getting a different view of the world. So for me, it was an amazing time. It was an enlightening time. It was eye-opening time. When I was able to challenge my thoughts on the world, my thoughts of being, you know, a U.S. citizen, my thoughts on so many different things. So it was a great time, really.
I love that. It's like if you hadn't gone to Ireland, you wouldn't have met your wife. That's crazy to think of, right?
Definitely, definitely. Well, I never would have met my wife. I never would have had my eyes open to questioning or challenging the U.S.'s position in the world and their relationship with other countries and things like that. So it definitely, you know, broadened my perspective and outlook on life and, you know, different cultures as well, too. Like I said, my relationship with South Asian or Indian culture was minimal to nil. You know, I didn't know about, you know, Diwali, and I didn't know about all of these great festivities, foods. I didn't, you know, there was so much that I didn't know at that point in time. So it was just such an enlightening time to just challenge things and become intrigued about things and curious and just start to do my own research into things.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a little bit about your relationship. Firstly, burning question, what was your wedding like?
Our wedding was really, really cool. We had some of my family from Uganda that was there. Sveta had some of her family from India. There were aunties and uncles from, you know, across the world who are like her parents' classmates and things, and they all go to everyone's kids' weddings when that time comes around. So it was such a kind of mixed affair, whether that was musically or down to the food or just the people there. It was really, really beautiful. Had a really, really good time, enjoyed it. And it was just a beautiful day watching the different people and cultures and everything like that come together for a celebration, really.
Were you ever worried about what would happen when your families met?
Not really. I mean, after I actually had the chance to meet my now in-laws, I mean, we're cool, you know? You know, they love me, I love them. We have love for each other. They respect me, they respect what I do, and similar, you know, the feeling's similar. My parents are quite easygoing as well, too. I don't think either one of us had a feeling like there was going to be some massive argument between them or anything like that. So I think once we got over the fact of me being able to meet Sweetie's parents and everything like that, I think we kind of knew that was going to be the hardest part. Our parents getting along or anything like that wasn't going to be the real obstacle.
Mm. I ask this because I can speak for the South Asian community. I know that a lot of parents are they sometimes get a bit concerned about obviously there may be a potential language barrier. There may be a huge cultural barrier. What would they talk about? You know, it's like the little things. So sometimes there's not that worry of like, oh, we're not going to get along, because sometimes there's a worry of genuinely just not even being on a level where you can like, you know, hold a long conversation and things like that. I think there are these fears, right?
Yeah. And I think that's it so it's kind of the fear of the unknown, really, which I think is part of the reason that some people are hesitant at times. So just as you were saying, when there isn't that interaction or you don't have a reference point and your reference point is, oh, I saw CNN, for example, and I've been seeing a lot of black people, for example, let's say getting arrested, right? They're all troublemakers and things like that. I remember speaking to an auntie, and, you know, we're just talking about when she was growing up and things like that. And it was like, well, what was your, you know, what did they teach you about black people? You know, what was your interaction? Now, obviously, there aren't loads of black people running around in India, unless you're in certain specific parts. So I think they were just being told stuff from kind of a textbook almost. And, you know, you don't have that reference point. You're not mixing with the people. You don't see how they live. You start to form stereotypes and biases about these people. And when you don't know, obviously it can lead to it to being the worst. So you think that you can't relate to them. You think that the families aren't alike. You think that because you don't know, you think this, you think that. But, you know, for example, my father's a cardiologist. Sweetie's father is a GP. He was an ENT. Her mother, my auntie, was a medic as well, too. So right there with that connection with medicine, you've probably seen other medic and people of the same profession hang out. You know, that's an immediate kind of point that you guys can relate to. And it goes back to whenever you started studying medicine, you know, all of these years ago. So you have a lot in common. You know, they'll both have the common kind of immigrant experience from a different viewpoint, but a lot of it still is similar. So there are a lot of things that are in common, but a lot of points in time, people just don't extend themselves to find out what that other lived experience is like. So you fear it, and it's just the unknown, which makes you even more kind of scared about it.
It is always the fear of the unknown. And it's like you can't talk sense into them because they're right in fearing it because they've not experienced it, yeah. right? So yeah. it's only until you experience it that, yeah. that you actually, it's fine.
Which is, yeah, which is, I think, just speaking about the Blending Project, it, you know, it's working to normalize Black and South Asian relationships. And we do that through, you know, a variety of different ways. You know, it could be simple as a story and just seeing that couple and, you know, knowing that, oh yeah, they face that. Yeah, we have faced that as well too. Just normalizing it and putting it out there and letting people, you know, visually see it and just making it an everyday thing.
Are there other organizations out there doing similar work, or would you say that you couldn't see any, which is why you were motivated to start one?
No, I think there are. So they're in different guises. I know there was this woman. Her handle is Growing Up Gupta, and she tells stories as well too. It'd be couple stories. Hers is essentially, let's call it a template that is sent out to couples who want to participate, and they all fill it into somewhat the same. So the stories have the same kind of basic format. But apart from that, really, there aren't many pages that are doing this, which is awesome. I feel like we have the opportunity to define what this swim lane looks like, really. And, you know, just kind of create the lane for ourselves, which is awesome.
It absolutely is. And do you think you've learnt quite a lot through that experience?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm learning new things every day. You learn so much by speaking to people and hearing about the experiences of other people and just listening and talking to people, really. I'm definitely a people person, you know, going all the way back to when I was a kid and I've always loved technology and remember being on like AOL and chat rooms and just speaking mm-hmm. to random people with no screen and like no visuals and anything like that. So it's great. It's great. You know, every day I'm learning at my age and whether it's about religion, new religions or stereotypes, negative perceptions. And it's just really exciting and interesting. And I love the work because it's about trying to bring together and unify our cultures that people oftentimes don't really see as being similar. So I love it. And we have two kids, right? We have two Blending kids. So they're going to grow up in this world. So I very much feel that I straddle both communities, I'm part of both communities, and therefore trying to uplift both sides as well too.
And actually, speaking of your kids, would you say that as parents, you're both very conscious to make sure that they have almost like equal amounts of both of your cultures in? How does that work?
100%. I mean, my in-laws live less than 5 minutes down the road from us, so that we see them quite a bit, which is great. Now, obviously, they want to ensure that our kids, you know, that they appreciate and understand we're part of their background and cultures from. So they're very active in terms of trying to get the kids to go to, again, festivities and holidays and different things like that and just partake. But at the same point in time, it's a very mixed and blended upbringing. Sveta lived in Ireland. So, you know, there's, you know, mixed celebrations. You know, it could be Navaratri, it could be Christmas, it could be Diwali, it could be all these different things. And I think it's beautiful, you know, get the best of both worlds. You get to experience all these different holidays. You get to get these different foods. You get to get different presents. You get to just be, I mean, it's a new world, right? Technology has reduced all of these barriers that used to kind of restrict us from doing things. And I don't think there's anything better than just being a global citizen of this world, able to slip in and out of different cultures and different countries, whether that's as a traveler or stuck in your home, really. Just knowing how the world works and functions.
Do you think that their upbringing is very different now compared to the way you or your wife grew up?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. 100%. I mean, we played outside. We played, we swam in creeks. We played war with fake guns and things like this. We didn't have iPads. We didn't sit in the house like gaming for 10, 12 hours. I mean, we were outside and running around and, you know, exploring kind of wilderness and things like that. And I think today and today's kids, like I said, I talked about iPads and technology and all of this different type of stuff. It's just very, very different. Now you worry about screen time. I mean, screen time wasn't really a thing back then. You know, it was more, if you're talking about the screen, it's like, don't sit too close by the TV. But, you know, you don't really have these little devices that you're effectively kind of getting addicted to and, you know, need to stay sane at times. So a much, much different world than when I grew up.
Okay, would you say that Black and South Asian interracial couples are actually a lot more common than we think?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, yeah, and I hear a lot of people say the same thing. They say that they never knew that they never met another couple until they found the page. They never interacted with them, etc. I mean, as a person who edits the stories that puts out there, like, I'm fascinated by the amount of people that I'll get coming through, and it'll just be a rush. And then the interesting thing is, I've had people who have shared their story, and then like they've met a cousin who lives in a different part of the world, and found out that they're like, that cousin is in a blending relationship too. And then they've met up on the page. You know, it's happened so many different times. It's been like, oh, I know so-and-so. And like, do you know them? Like, well, yeah, I know them and stuff. So it's just beautiful seeing like all of the different connections.
That is amazing. I didn't know that. Actually unbelievable.
I gotta share that. But it was like, two people, one of them's from the USA or Canada, and the other one was like in Africa. And they're like, hold on, do you know so-and-so? They're like, yeah, we do. They're like, that's my third cut. You know, and they're like, oh, it's so great to see. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, it's just like so beautiful to be able to bring people together around a common cause and then have them, you know, just kind of like celebrating, being uplifted. And it's just beautiful.
It's also incredible that they trust your platform to come and speak about their story, often not having shared their experiences with their own family members. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about community and what community means and how do you build community. And that's one of the things is being vulnerable. Being vulnerable is, I personally think it's such an important skill to have. If you can be vulnerable, it allows people to let down their guards. It allows them to be vulnerable. And when they feel comfortable in sharing their story, it's a beautiful thing for the people who are able to experience that story. But it's also so powerful for the people who are finally able to tell their story in a space that they feel is judgment free. And again, it goes back to this kind of feeling of you have this dove in your hand and, you know, you've just like let it out and let it fly and into the world and stuff. But it's really interesting because now the blending project, it's not so much about me and my story. Whereas when I started it, it was predominantly content or pictures or photos about my living experience. It doesn't need to be about me anymore. So I remember recently we had our anniversary, and one of the things I did is I shared my story for our anniversary. And I remember it was just kind of, like I said before, even though I had released and like told my story in different kind of shapes and guises before, this was the first time like I was kind of officially like putting the post out there. Mm-hmm. And I remember like I felt feeling like a bit kind of nervous like prior to pressing the button to publish. But afterwards, it was such like such an empowering moment in time and experience just to have all of the people. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but like when there are new stories of the couples, like you get loads of people who will just like, even if it's just like them taking a second to send like a heart or, you know, a few words or a paragraph or just people taking time out of their day to express how the story touched them. So it's just really empowering to see that and just be uplifted and people being appreciative of you letting down your guard and, you know, sharing with the world.
It is. There is so much strength in vulnerability. I think people misunderstand what it is to be vulnerable. They think it's a weakness. But I think the work that you're doing, and I see it, you know, that is representation in its purest form. Like for me now, you know, interracial couples, like, you know, Black and South Asian couples, it's a normal thing because of the work that you're doing. And I'm sure it's probably motivating other people to speak about their stories or even starting similar initiatives, which is also a wonderful thing. Let's talk about how that makes you feel. Does it make you feel like, oh, you know, like there should be only one or two like genuine pages doing this? Or because I mean, the reason I asked this is because I've seen in lockdown, you know, so many new platforms have opened up. Everybody started a side hustle. Everybody started, you know, a podcast. And a lot of people are talking about the same thing. And, you know, not maybe not the exact same thing, but they'll talk about it from their own lens, which initially a part of me was like, oh, this is just hype. You know, people are just bored and, you know, they're not going to keep it up. But actually, I find like I had to teach myself that the work that we do, it's so important to get more and more voices and like different perspectives.
For sure. I mean, how do I feel about it? So I'm a creative and stuff. So I know that everything or a lot that's built has already been done before, right? Mm. It's been built before. You're referencing it. You are getting inspiration for it. You're tweaking it. You're trying to turn it your own. It's been funny, really. You know, I've had some people who have pinged me, you know, males and females, and been like, damn you, I had this idea a really, really long time ago. I wish I would have done it, you know? And then we just have a laugh and just like, yeah, but you didn't do it and I did it. So there you go. You can jump into the fray now if you want to, but, no, it's fine. It's competition. It's believing that the work you're doing is so much more different to what the other people are doing. It keeps you on your toes. It keeps you fresh. It's all part of the game, really.
Definitely. You know? Your point about making it yours, I think, because everyone has the power to create something completely unique in a way. That is, I guess it is a big source of motivation. Do you think that the work that you do now, do you reckon it will keep motivating you in the few years to come? And I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how do you see this work evolving over time?
Oh, yeah. So I am 2017, I started the project and I launched it, had it out there for a while. I'm a creative. So as you know, us creatives go off and do different things. Oftentimes you don't want to be defined by a piece of work. And I think some of these things have time limits to them and shelf lives to them. So at the beginning of 2020, I was probably working on about 5 to 7 different things, not putting much focus into any of them really. And I took stock and I said, what am I working on that I feel makes me feel valued? At the same point in time, puts the most kind of joy and gives the world the most value. And I landed on this project and I've decided to put everything that I had into this. And the idea and the concept behind it has grown. I think, well, I know when COVID-19 coronavirus came and hit, it stopped a lot of things, growth and progression that I had, because prior to the end of the year, I had just started to get into kind of experiential, face-to-face, live experiences, kind of art, music, culture, conversation, all mixed into one. So that was where Blending Project was going to go to. And this has kind of put a pause on it. It's allowed us to grow and expand virtually, which I think is a thing that a lot of people will need to get their heads around. Probably allowed me to focus on building the online community as well too. But no, there are a lot of thoughts and ideas, and I'm starting to meet and interact with a group of people who are on a similar kind of wavelength and trying to do similar things. And these are people whose work I, you know, value tremendously. So I'm just trying to incorporate it all into what I hope will turn into a touring, traveling piece of work. I think to something that we said earlier today, when you don't experience something yourself face to face or have any kind of experiences with these people or cultures, you start to form oftentimes kind of negative stereotypes and biases. So when I mentioned this traveling and touring, I very much think the Blending Project is a project that, you know, can travel within England. You know, I'd love to go to up north, Manchester, you know, Birmingham, places like that. I know it can go to the States, it can go to New York City, it can go to Toronto. I'd love to go to India with it and just allow it to touch people around the world and question all of these thoughts and things that they've been told that are, you know, many times false.
Yeah, it is breaking those misconceptions, and that's what's so important to do. And you're doing it so well.
Thank you.
I also wanted to touch upon the fact that I know that this is not your full-time thing, and I wanted to ask you, what else do you do for work and how do you manage it?
Yeah, so I work in technology. I'm a consultant. I've been doing that since, I've been doing that for about 10 years now. Worked in London, so I've worked with the likes of Lloyds Banking Group, Bank of England, HSBC and Canary Wharf. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it gets hectic. I mean, it's very much about being organized. I have the two kids, we have the two kids as well, too. So, obviously it's about, spending the days, working on the professional side of things and things that pay the bills at the present time and having time for the kids. And then, this little night creative slot that I have where I speak with people such as yourself and work on my own projects. So it's just, trying to be regimented and have some type of a schedule that I follow.
I'm fascinated by that because you always give me the same time. And is that like your time slot?
It is. That's all I tell people. I say, you can get me after 9:30 PM anytime before that, really. I mean, if I'm trying to put the kids to sleep or get them food or do their studies and things like that, it's never really going to work. And I'm trying to be much more intentional about even little things like not having my mobile on me all the time and surfing in front of them and, checking my mail and different things like that. I mean, I think it's natural when you're trying to get some momentum going and just like push something forward, you become engrossed in it and it can become really addictive. I've been finding a lot of peace in leaving my phone charging somewhere else in the house or away from me and just trying to be present more when I'm with my family and my kids.
You're actually very right in that it becomes addictive. I'd never thought of it that way. But actually, since I've been posting more on our Insta page, I've completely taken kind of a step back on my personal one, which used to be the main one that I used to post on. And really interestingly, someone messaged me yesterday, like someone I don't know, who was like, "Hey, are you okay?" And it's because I hadn't posted in so long about I do dancing and I post a lot of dance videos and I just haven't in a long time because I've been focusing on this. And it's just so funny because, you're right. It just, you get so engrossed in it. And it's really cool that you're very regimented with your time schedule and you're like, okay.
I mean, I'm not perfect by any means, but I'm trying to get much better with it. Like you say, I always tell you that time. So I do have this 9:30 time slot. I'm building this time out where it's like I finish work 5 and, solid to about 8:30-ish where I'm just with the kids and with them and, hanging out with my wife, Sveta. And I'm trying to get there. I mean, the whole COVID situation has been so crazy. It's kind of thrown our lives upside down. But at the same point in time, I think there have been a lot of benefits that have came out of it in terms of family life and just kind of building bonds with the family.
Do you ever find the work you do with Blidion Project to kind of almost mesh with your life in tech and in consulting? Have you ever seen them merge or do you just keep them very separate?
Yeah, I think they're merging. A lot of my work it's all lived experience. So, the tech part or the consultancy part of it, it's knowledge that I have. And ultimately, I mean, it merges into the Blidion Project in the sense that all of the forms of kind of communicating and communication I'm able to do is transmitted via and because of technology. That's what enables it and allows it to happen. So, yeah, there's a blur between that and what I do with my professional life, my just life in general.
Yeah, I think I would probably go a step further and say that the skills that you pick up as well in the workplace, they apply, it's like they're interchangeable almost. So I found that, recording this has definitely given me the confidence to speak on Zoom calls with clients I've never met.
Yeah, 100%. Or even just using Excel, using PowerPoint to communicate a message, as in not having thousands of words on the slide, but just like being able to boil it down to a set of bullet points, to knowing how to arrange those bullet points, to then having that merge into how to post effectively to social media and convey the same message, and what does the copy say, and how do you get your message across, it turns very much into a mindset or personality that can transfer between both of those both of those instances or experiences.
Who says you only have to do one thing anyway?
I know. Tell me about it. Six different things, seven different things.
Love that. Okay, last question for you, Jonah. So obviously, since this podcast is called Brown Game Strong, I want to ask you, what do you have strong game in? And what could you have stronger game in?
What do I have strong game in? So I think I have strong game in nurturing relationships with people and community building.
Love that. And what is one thing that you could be stronger in, maybe?
I can definitely be more organized. Definitely be more organized.
High five to that.
Can always be more organized.
Yeah, I couldn't do the, you know, the people who do revision notes and they have like everything color coded and all that. Yeah. Or like Excel sheets for absolutely everything.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. But I've actually done some pretty cool stuff with that when I've been revising for exams. But I don't go completely overboard, but I can see what they're trying to do.
It's really funny, but I find it really respectable when someone really looks disorganized but seems to have all their shit together. I find that fascinating. I'm like, how do you hold all of this in your head? Like, considering you just seem to be all over the place. But yeah, I think there's a fine balance there, definitely.
Definitely. And you see a lot of like great, amazing creatives who aren't. Likewise, you might see their work and things like that and be like, oh man, I'd love to see their workspace, something like that. You could go see their workspace and it's completely just like a tip and a mess. But like there are or could be like completely pristine with like these fine lines and all of these different things, you know?
Yeah, says so much about their personalities.
Yeah.
All right. Definitely. Well, thank you so much once again for coming on. It's been really interesting talking to you.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Love being here. And I think for the first time we talked, I love what you were trying to do and love what the podcast was talking about. And just felt really, really genuine and good. So thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Jonah. And keep doing the amazing work that you're doing with the Blindian Project.
Thank you.